Okay, well, Peter, as you know, we invited the audience last night, both present and those unable to attend, to submit questions to you as follow-up and to pursue some of the issues you raised. We received a lot of complimentary notes without questions, thanking you for your work, both past and present, and a number of questions which are pushing some of the issues you raised. So let's go through some of these and see where it takes us. First question, a good place to start. You mentioned in the lecture you have a specific date marking the end of cinema. What date was that again?
Well, those obviously people who might play my game know the game, know the date has to be apocryphal, because I always say it's the 31st of September, but we all know there is no such thing.
Yes, and in fact, this questioner, Zara, caught that. So does that, he asked, does that date represent something other than just a non-existent day?
Well, they say, I mean, the historians of the digital movement are getting together, aren't they, and they're grouping and they're working out consensus continuities and so on. And it is thought for a whole series of introduction of technological new developments into the public field that the year 1983 is considered to be an important year for the beginnings of what we understand as the digital revolution. And they say the latter part because, in a sense, it's related to academia and the sort of term time situation. So, I don't know, for me, I used to go back to school in England around about that time too. So, for me, I suppose that's a little personalized. But we could say safely, I think, the autumn of 1983.
So, in your talks, you often associate the date with the introduction of what we call over here the remote control, and the same person was pushing you on that, I think perhaps taking you too literally, because he does point out that Zenith Corporation introduced the remote control in the 50s and they were proliferated in the 70s. So,
well, the full statement, I think, was the cinema died on the 31st of September 1983 when the Zappa or the remote control was introduced into the living rooms of the world. So, the industrial date might be rather different from the more domestic acceptance of it.
Mm-hmm. And this is me now. Do you think that the Zapper, the remote control, is actually more significant, or is it really just a precursor to something like this, sort of the
Well, I've always thought of it, yeah, it indicates choice. I mean, a very simple, primitive choice, of course. What could you do? You could switch on and off. You could maybe switch channels. I'm not even certain at that time you had any control over the color or the contrast. That might have even come a bit later. But it was the indications of the first time from a distance that you were beginning to indicate customer choice, which you'd never been able to before. And of course, we've traveled enormous distances since that time.
So going in a related direction, Connie asks, and I think this is something that you addressed in the lecture last night as well, do you feel that cinema today is enslaved by narrative?
Well, I think it's always been. I mean, my accusations are towards that wretched man, Griffiths. I know that cinema histories always clap him on the back and say, at last, you know, notions of continuity and ideas of synthesis of material from a disparate sort of organized cinema before that time could be successfully laid at his door. But I mean, I think, you know, just to conduct a very simple experiment, if I were to ask you to tell me the plot of the movie you saw in the cinema last night, okay, it would be fresh in your mind and you could probably sum it up maybe in a couple of sentences, but before very long, the actual detailing and the structure of the story would begin to disappear. And if I were to ask you to tell me the story of Casablanca or a movie made some time ago, again, you could probably give me a one-liner. But essentially, that's not really what is really indicative, I believe, of what you remember. The cinematic experience is a particular audio-visual phenomenon, and it's more related to a performance or an event or a sort of genius loci in cinematic form rather than, you know, a grasp of the glue, if you like, or the cement of the narrative. And if that is the case, and I can convince you of that, then that surely minimalizes the actual power of the narrative to be essential. So it's like we have to have cement to gather together disparate parts and organize the drama. But once it's performed its purpose, it somehow disappears from the notions of your memory. Of course, and it depends often about how powerful the image initially is and also its context. I'd also link it to the idea that is said, and I would believe it, that the very best painting is non-narrative. And if you want to make an imagistic cinema, then we have to, in a way, not use the literary device, and these are profoundly literary devices, in order to structure something which is not really about text at all. It's very easy for people to fall into the trap of believing that a text and an image are somehow sharing exactly the same sorts of obligations and responsibilities, but it just isn't the case. And I would argue again, and some people would find it difficult maybe, when I would say that although we've had 115 years of so-called cinema, there is a way, in fact, you know, what is this phenomenon called cinema? Are you saying really we've had 115 years of illustrated text? We could go around and around this subject, and sometimes perhaps we can become more imagistic and all of us can find movies which we feel have much more greater, owe a much greater debt to the notion of image perfection and consideration. But I mean, you know, let me mention an English lady, Emma Thompson, who continually remakes films about Jane Austen. And Jane Austen has become a mainstay of a certain part of English cinema making. But the activities are, you know, to take the book and to necessarily shorten it and prune it and clip it down and organize it deliberately into a shooting script. But it still remains indubitably a literary product, it strikes me, and not a product that comes from the heart of picture making.
So we have some other questions that are pushing you a bit on this question of a new kind of cinema. So Juvenio asks, how do we create new cinematic experiences that top the shock and breakthrough of what films like Anchi en Andalou from 1929 were to early film?
Well, I think it was Mallarmé who suggested that we should all read novels before we're 21. Maybe we should all see all our cinema before we're 21. The basis behind that is this phenomenon of the suspension of disbelief and our growing cynicism not to believe anymore in the phenomenon. And also maybe, I suppose, ongoing cynicism, not only about the art itself and cinema, but life as well. I don't know, there's this enormous sort of naivety, isn't there, in the way that we are somehow, I mean, cinema always strikes me as a very naive proposition. I mean, look at the things that we demand of cinema. For example, most of cinema, I think, at heart is about sex and death in one way or another. Sex incredibly desensualized and also death incredibly deodorized, if you wish. But there's a way that, you know, we demand of our actors and actresses that they should fuck or die. And the chances are we ask them to do it sooner rather than later. And we know they're not fucking, and we're pretty certain they're not dying. So we all travel along this intellectual knife edge, knowing full well in our total sentience that what we're looking at is just completely untrue. So we enter into a special contract with the film. But we've only got to pinch ourselves for one moment and say, what are we doing here? How can we possibly imagine what we're asked to imagine? Which seems rather like, you know, getting a child to believe in Father Christmas. It'll go up till maybe they're 6 or 7 years old, but then, wah, the lie is exposed. So I personally, I suppose what I'm saying now is very indicative of a very personal predicament, I find it very, very difficult to suspend disbelief. I suggest that maybe, you know, many filmmakers would do that anyway because they're deeply involved in the mechanics and they remember the circumstances and they know that one good performance probably required, you know, 3 weeks of rehearsal. So the pretenses and the layers of artifice are infinite. But I think, you know, I don't know, people are so familiar with the cinematic experience, even though they might not make it, they know an awful lot about it these days. And then again, I would suggest, you know, let's call it the Father Christmas complex.
Well, another question, this one from Ghoul, and it has to do with the cinematic experience. He or she is wondering, if your new project requires immersive environments to project on, does that mean you're abandoning the commercial movie theater environment for good? And if so, where do you plan to show your work?
Well, I'm not so sure that really I could be described as a commercial filmmaker. on one level, again, that's a bit stupid because, you know, I need a lifestyle and I need to be paid for what I do. I'm certainly not a rich man, but I certainly get recompenses. You know, I'm not living in the gutter, so there is that nexus of money versus art performance, which certainly works with me. I suppose through my training as a painter, and notoriously, I suppose, you know, there have been millions of painters we've never ever heard of, and even at this very moment, as we speak, there are many, many, many hundreds of thousands of painters who are totally, totally unsung. But there is a way that the painter has now established for himself, I think after 2,000 years, of a certain sort of responsibility and individuality as an auteur, that the circumstances of painting, Picasso said, nobody needs a painting until you painted it. So there's a curious way, it's a very ad hoc proposition, but it's one both the general public and the painter knows about. I mean, I don't think the way I'm describing a painter now would not have been true in the 14th century, would not even true in the 17th century, but it's true now. And I think, you know, with that sort of basis, I would like to imagine I could be a film director like a painter is a painter. But that's difficult, of course, because, again, you have to watch this. They say that filmmaking is very expensive. It really isn't and doesn't have to be. And they also say that filmmaking is a huge collaborative activity which needs an awful lot of networking in all its stages of production. And again, it doesn't have to be. We all know, if we haven't experienced it, all over the world there's a huge amount of so-called underground cinema which participates in the activity with extraordinary amounts of professionalism and an ability to follow things through, even though it doesn't get, you know, magnificently publicized and it's not open to everybody to see. So it is possible, I think, you know, for people, and I've tried very hard, if I could go back to that definition, I want to make films like a painter paints paintings. There is one big difference. Painting has an extremely low technology. I can take the grease from the side of my nose and a piece of paper or even the carpet on this floor and I can start making what legitimately could be described as a painting. Now it's very, very difficult, and that very, very simple technology to be able to make a film. But not so difficult. We shouldn't expand the gap so big. But there's another exciting thing, I think, about painting. There's a curiosity about painting that somehow you are allowed to fail. You're allowed to fail. That painting, certainly in the 20th century, we've seen this over and over again, is a huge, huge theater of investigation, always investigation. You're never quite certain what's going to come out of it. It's no way formulaic. I don't think it is. I suppose, you know, the downside of that, you know, very famous painters somehow get stuck in a formula, maybe organized by their agents and their public and their galleries. We could name names. Miro, for example, a supreme example. After having established, you know, his style, I think he spent nearly 35 years virtually painting the same painting. And there are other people we can, of course, mention in this particular way. So low technologies and the permission to fail, I think, makes painting an extraordinary medium. Again, it's a cliche, but you know what they say about cinema, you know, two bad films and you're out.
You know, I'm thinking of one of my other favorite filmmakers, Herzog, who I think lives over there somewhere these days. I read that he thinks if you take longer than 30 days to make a film, you're wasting time and money. How long do you take, and do you subscribe to his notion of simplicity in filmmaking? Simplicity, probably not the right word, but...
Economy, should we say economy of filmmaking? Well, again, maybe it's a sort of, you know, it's a conceit, but I always think it takes about 9 months human gestation period to make a movie. Maybe it's a bit of an exaggeration. Maybe from the moment you're sure you've got the money to the moment the screen is finally being premiered is about 9 months. But you know that famous dialogue between Ruskin and Whistler? Whistler, the American painter who became very anglicized, irritated the conservative critic Ruskin because Whistler could turn off a painting in about 45 minutes. And Ruskin was used to the idea, the pre-Raphaelites, it would take, you know, 8 years to make a painting. And he actually took him to court, accused him of throwing a paint pot in the face of the public in a rather sort of angry way. And conservative London, Ruskin, actually won his case, but it was only awarded one penny damages, which is really an indication. because Whistler's defense was very good. He'd say, I might have painted this painting in 45 minutes, but look, I'm 42 now. So in a sense, it's taken me 42 years to make this painting. And I think that in a curious way can be made applicable to any act of creativity and certainly be applied to the cinema.
So speaking of filmmaking, Stuart, who did attend last night, asks, you stated that in the future a Greenaway film would never be the same length twice. This seems to imply using improvisation that will change the duration of the film. Is this correct? Did he understand you correctly?
Well, it could be correct. It's just that I think this is deeply relevant to the new media. We all know how fast now the production rate can be and how malleable it can be. In the old days when you shot on celluloid, you know, you'd have to perfect your, should we say, your cutting copy rather well, for example, before you send it to the laboratories. You send it to the laboratories and you somehow lost control. It was in the hands of mechanics and obviously very, very well trained and very professional people, but it went out of your hand and probably disappeared for 3 weeks. It wasn't yours anymore. It belonged to, you know, chemical baths and all that sort of activity. And when you came in, when you came back, certainly if it was full of opticals, you could be certain, absolutely certain, that 50% were wrong. You'd have to send it back in again. So, you know, if I finished a film on a Monday night, it might be 3 months before finally I got the final finished film back. Tape now, I can finish on a Friday night. It could be on a screen to my satisfaction on a Saturday morning. That indicates fantastic manipulability. There's also, of course, a finance factor here too. These things change as we become more proficient and more familiar. Things rapidly get cheaper very, very quickly. But there is that malleability of time and money and forces which now make, should we say, the medium very lightweight when it used to be very heavyweight. And I like the idea. You know, why? You know, why do we have to believe in the notion of permanence? There are 3,000 million different ways that Casablanca could be reconsidered. Remember, Godard said, the cinema is supposedly the truth 24 frames a second. So if you might only choose to change one frame in every 24, it is already beginning to become a different sort of film. You can imagine the fallout, though, for recognized distribution systems. Where would we be? You know, is this Mark 429/7, or is this Mark 429/AB4? You'd have to think completely differently. But you know, there's a really Borges interesting short story. He said a true history of the world has to be a history of every single one of its inhabitants, living or dead. So let's say in this sort of megalomania position, I would like to make a film, a separate film for every person in the audience. Now, mind-bogglingly complex, but not impossible, not impossible at all. So, you know, there's a way, I think, that malleability, which people maybe take too lightly, is very much a part of what we're playing with now. I'm in a very, very privileged position. I think because of the nature, the characteristics of my film, that, you know, I can, in a curious way, transmogrify, metamorphize it across the board. So an opera can become stage play. A stage play can become a film can become a television series, could become an exhibition of photographs. And that ability to maneuver now is very attractive. Many, many people are doing it. And again, you know, I'm allowed the privilege to be able to do that. I still am, maybe stupidly, you know, because I think to make feature films now is some curious fossilized activity. I was deeply, deeply fascinated by the medium and what it can do. And the, you know, its vocabulary changes every afternoon with the invention of some new phenomenon, that I want to go on practicing it. But I'm quite certain, you know, that the audiences are going to drop off and drop off and drop off. When I first made films in a way back in the 60s with a 16mm Bolex, which had a spring-loading capacity of about 17 seconds, so I could never make a shot longer than 17 seconds, which was an interesting discipline. There was a way, you know, I did those sorts of things with enormous delight. But I was making those films basically for my brother and his dog. I had an audience of two, and one was an animal. And I have a feeling now, after a grand parabola, I shall end up doing the same thing. But now, you know, I'll be making, you know, movies on high definition and long gone the black and white.
And dogs have become much more sophisticated viewers now, so.
Yeah, but it still might be, you know, my brother without his dog now. But then again, you know, maybe it's almost that religious phrase, you know, Jesus Christ said, It only takes one convert to make my whole life worthwhile.
You mentioned anecdotally yesterday that back 20, 30 years ago when you would travel, everyone wanted to be a film director. Now everyone wants to be a curator. Mm. In a way, you're describing the new filmmaking as being akin to curating, although in the same breath, I note that our Microsoft Word checker, spell checker, doesn't accept curate as a verb. It only accepts curate and curator as nouns. So, are you a curate?
I don't know, that sounds like a minor priest in England. Something different. Well, maybe not something so very different. I don't know, let me answer your question slightly from a sideways view. I noticed in all the bookshops, and I'm a great bookshop goer all over the world now, are full in the history section of histories of the world. You know, it's not histories of LA, it's not even histories of California, it's not even histories of the United States, it's histories of the world. Everybody's now feels they're in a good position to globally grasp the total phenomenon of what the earth is all about, man-made, God-made. And I think in a curious way, you know, we've all become sort of encyclopedists. We're all pretty knowledgeable now. I mean, as all those people are fortunate to go on to secondary education. So by the time we're 25, but I mean, you just spend your days in front of a television screen or in front of the internet, and we can all become very knowledgeable, if knowledgeable means the accumulation of facts.
Well, in fact, so knowledge is no longer power, it's organization of knowledge
exactly.
That is power.
And which also means, as a corollary to that, you know, the gatekeepers, the people who know how to maneuver themselves around this knowledge, who are curators, are very powerful people, because they are the apostles of knowledge. So I think people have grasped this idea, you know, that to be knowledgeable makes you rich. I mean, makes you rich in feeling and experience and in a joyous way. I always feel that. But then the next problem is that how do we organize it? How do we place it? How do we classify it? How do we make it best to be receptible for as many people and certainly for ourselves? So no wonder people want to become these powerful gatekeeping sort of encyclopedists. And as again, I think we mentioned last night, I ticked off a little list of all my favorite encyclopedists.
So we've exhausted these questions. One more area that I want to explore.
One second, we're actually running out of memory, so I'm going to switch.
Okay.
I'm going to switch the card real quick.
Isn't it a bit disconcerting to realize that we are being filmed in front of what looks like still?
No, I would say that's a good. It's a good way to. Get away from camera anxieties. I didn't hear you click, so you must not have taken our picture.
There goes one.
And then he puts in this little tiny, tiny chip.
Mm. All right.
So I want to bring it back around to the paintings project. You've been critical of narrative cinema, and you've also made the point that probably every movie we've ever seen began as a text. In a way, you're now creating cinematic experiences off of these paintings. Maybe that's your answer. We're beginning here with a painting. But they do have a strong narrative tendency, certainly the Veronese project. Mm.
So The Last Supper, it's an illustration of a very famous text. Yeah.
So,
no,
is there a strong relationship?
I'm very aware of this. You know, we've had, let's say we've had 8,000 years of painting. Depends where you pitch it from. I suppose in modern history, I always think sort of Roman wall paintings. So if you think of somewhere like Pompeii, sort of AD 60, is about the sort of beginnings of how we perceive the parabola of painting adventures. So let's say we've had 2,000 years of painting, and it's been thrown around from different sorts of imaginations, different sorts of purposes, different sorts of obligations across the whole of the European and the Western world. And that's created a huge opportunity for masses of investigation. Thanks again to modern technology, you know, we're able to preserve this and to continue it in other art forms. We don't go to Pompeii, you know, every Sunday afternoon, but we've got books of Pompeii, and we use those as a you know, certain and believable representation of what is there. So we did say we've had, you know, 2,000 years then of intense painterly experience on one level. You have to be a bit careful about that too, I think, because the average sort of, should we say, uneducated, pre-literate peasant in Europe probably would have only seen maybe only four representations in a whole lifetime. You know, probably three of those in the church, and if he's lucky, maybe he might have seen a chapbook or, you know, some sort of easily a throwaway sort of printing activity. But I mean, you probably saw the Virgin Mary, certainly saw Christ, and maybe you saw St. Peter. But that was it. But you reverse that situation now. I have a 9-year-old daughter. I mean, she knows there are white tigers in Siberia. I don't think she's ever going to see anything. I don't see those white tigers. But there's a way, you know, the representations now are so omnipresent. They're more omnipresent than life is. So virtual reality is more omnipresent than reality. So the whole switch around has changed. But what I keep asking for, you know, is about the value of this. Have, you know, the products of 8,000 years of painting already given us more profundity, more sincerity, more ideas and understandings of our condition than 115 years of this recent, very recent development called cinema? So in a sense, I'm pitching, I don't feel, you know, amazingly, profoundly sort of informative. I try very hard to be, but I do know something about painting and I do know something about cinema. And I'm, again, it's a personal disenchantment. I spent my whole career in association with these two great areas of experience, and I'm sort of weighing them up. What are they giving me? What are they giving us? What do they think their purposes are? And also, I think, you know, we have a very, very text-based society. We're very sophisticated in handling text, both written and spoken, even across all the language barriers. Why can't we siphon off a part of this activity to be associated particularly with what painting does on its own, without the succedaneum, without the support, without the interference of text? Because text people, inevitably, they think differently from image people. I'm absolutely convinced about that. So I suppose it's a cri de coeur. Let's allow cinema, please, ladies and gentlemen, to have its own little purple space where it can perform and organize and explore without, you know, the heavy hand of text banging it on the head all the time. You know, the notion of the image is sort of wrapped up in the bandages of text. Let's throw away those bandages. Okay, you know, people would argue with me, but Mr. Greenwood, you know, there's no such thing as a pure art form. Every form is hybrid. Okay, maybe I'm being too churlish. Maybe cinema's far too young. 115 years isn't long enough. But I would argue, thinking about the representation that a 14th century peasant would see, there have been so many films made and they've been so ubiquitously visible all over the world. I think there's only one media form that's traveled quicker, and that must be the internet. So if you say cinema was invented in 1895, by 1905, practically everybody in the world, even the valleys of, you know, sort of the East Indies, somehow curiously know about cinema. Even it might take another generation before they start making it, but they're aware of it. I think only the internet has traveled any faster, hasn't it? That's another thing, I suppose, and a huge opportunity for lots of discussion here, about notions of national cinema. You know, people say, oh, Japanese cinema is very different from American cinema. Is it? Is it really? You know, Japanese painting is infinitely different from Western cinema because it's taken a long, long time to evolve and slowly manipulated itself. But because the introduction of cinema has been so quick, everybody's really fallen into the same Richter level at the same time. You know, can you talk about Japanese internet and American internet? I don't think so. There's a way that those divisions in terms of national, you know, association, which is relevant to climate and meteorology and all the rest of it, have not evolved at all in the same way. Okay, let me reprise. What's my plea? Cinema seems to me to have enormous opportunities to be an autonomous phenomenon that can examine the whole business of the display and the exchange, the communication of ideas through visual means, and I'm afraid it has not fulfilled that purpose. That sounds very negative, but I do have enormous amounts of optimism. Because I think, again, you know, where we're going now, where we're scraping away a lot of the superfluity of what cinema is about, if I can make the comparison, people moaned, did they not, in the 1840s and 50s about photography creating a situation which would destroy painting. But exactly the opposite is amazingly true. Photography got rid of all the archival, recording, mimetic concerns of painting, to allow painting to get on with what it really did. And the proof of that is slowly starting through the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, and finally with Impressionism, is breaking away from notions of ideas of figuration, ideas of mimesis, ideas of being text dominated. and it opened up to that glorious activity of the whole of the 20th century. So what I'm hoping for now in parallel, that cinema will decide to give up narrativity and give up the notions of text and the notions of the bookshop and free itself to get on what I believe should be the permissible space to develop itself really free of all these trammels which it does not have to endure anymore.
Seems like a good point to wrap up. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity for me to stand on my soapbox again.